Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Aldi's editorial assistant. On the 27th of January next year, it will be 200 years since mariner Thaddeus von Bellinghausen saw the Antarctic, the first person to do so. The acclaimed travel writer and biographer Sarah Wheeler, who has travelled extensively in the Antarctic, is here to shed some light on the history of Antarctic exploration. So Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here again.
Glad to have you back. Apologies. So, who was Bellinghausen and what brought him to the Antarctic Circle?
Well, Bellinghausen was a distinguished mariner and became even more distinguished after this. And he was born in what's now Estonia, but he was working for the Russian Imperial Navy and has been sent to do a circumnavigation, and which he accomplished, of the Antarctic. And his was the second circumnavigation, and the aim was to generally scout, explore, map and claim anything that could be. It was the age of imperial expansion, and nothing was really known about what was there, whether there was a continent. It was thought that there was, because people like Captain Cook and various sealers had thought they'd spotted something, but nobody knew. And since the time of the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, there was this idea there was something down there. That's the reason it was called Antarctos, the opposite of the Arctos bear in the north. And it was thought that even it could be Atlantis, and that maybe there was sunshine and it was peopled by blonde-haired gods and goddesses. And in fact, Bellinghausen had stowed underneath in his man of war gifts, in case this was indeed the case. And sadly, we don't know what the gifts were, which would be interesting to know, wouldn't it? And so the significance, really, of what he achieved was he could see that the climate was not going to indeed get better as he went further south, and it was just ice, 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 and brutal all the way. And indeed, so there couldn't be any people living there, which of course there aren't any people living there. The continent doesn't sustain life because there's no water. It doesn't even sustain terrestrial life among animals. It only sustains marine life. So it's only penguins and the birds that live around the edge, and seals, because they eat in the ocean. There are no animals. It's an abiotic zone. It's like biological haiku. And he really, this first sighting gave us an insight into what it was like. Of course, they didn't really have any idea how big it was, because even though Cook had done the first circumnavigation and Bellinghausen himself did the second, they didn't know when they went all the way round whether it was, there might have been a great big oceans in the middle, whether it was all joined up, because for a lot of the time you can't see anything. And a lot of the problem about sighting Antarctica, and indeed travelling there even today, is there's land, but there's a huge amount of ice sheets, and you can't see where the ice sheet ends and the land begins. I mean, for example, the Ross Ice Shelf is the size of France, and at some point underneath this enormous amount of ice, the land stopped, but you can't see where. So you can't see whether it's a continent or not. And sealers at the time of Bellinghausen in the 19th century had already discovered various peri-Antarctic islands, of which there are a great deal. So everything anybody saw, they thought, well, is it another island or is it a continent? And Bellinghausen himself, he wasn't sure whether he'd seen a continent. To his credit, he didn't claim anything. He said, well, I saw a lot of ice hills and I think this and that. But their compass recordings were quite good. So most historians, and not just Russian ones, and people like me, pretty sure that he was indeed the first captain to set his eyes on the Antarctic continent, which, let's not forget, is more than 1.5 times the size of the continental United States. So it's a pretty big part of...
Yeah. So who was the first to set foot?
Well, it was possibly the American sealer John Davis, who claimed to have stepped ashore just a year after Bellinghausen. And it's plausible, although he might have been on another island, but it's plausible it was him. And of course, the age of sail ended after Captain James Clark Ross's Royal Navy research expeditions, and a lot of the continental coastline was charted during that period.
And that was on the Erebus, was it?
Yeah, that was aboard Erebus. That was between 1839 and 1843. So, like, really, how geographical advance has taken place elsewhere in the world, it's just much later in the Antarctic. it was we were inching forward with our knowledge of reliable maps. Mm-hmm. And James Clark Ross did a lot more to fill in all those gaps. And everything went quiet for quite a while because attention turned to the North. And the great prize was the North Pole. So everybody in the Royal Navy included sent masses of people up there with endless shoe-eating and disasters ensuing.
Mr. Franklin was one of the disasters,
one of the most famous shoe-eaters. And then all the expeditions that went to rescue him had to have rescue expeditions to rescue them. And it was all tremendous disasters left and right. And a lot of shoe-eating, a lot of deaths, and a lot of terribleness. And that, of course, was the big quest for the Northwest Passage, and that became much more attractive than the Antarctic, because it was, as it was thought, a route to the fabled riches of Cathay, which was the Holy Grail in terms of trade at the time. And so lots of attention up there. The Antarctic was reasonably neglected, I would say. And then in 1909, two separate American explorers claimed to have reached the North Pole, Peary and Cook. Mm-hmm. Now, not Captain Cook, another Cook. So that was kind of all over in terms of the media and attention and resources. Now, we know now almost certainly that neither of those two men did get to the North Pole. They falsified their data. But still, it appeared to have been ticked off. The North Pole had been ticked off. So eyes turned south from all points of view. There was no more talk of golden-haired races of people living down there. It was known. But what might be down there, who knew? And anyway, every nation was keen to be the one to claim it for themselves and be the first to plant the flag.
Almost like the moon, in a way.
It was very much like the moon. It was very much like the moon and like Everest. Mm. So then there became the heroic age, which is that very heady period, really at the, I won't say fin de siècle, but the Edwardian period, really, the first decade of the 20th century, which captured everybody's attention. And of course, there are these epic figures. Captain Scott, surely, maybe after Shakespeare and Nelson, one of the most famous Englishmen ever to have lived. Shackleton, that great showman. The Norwegian Roald Amundsen, and the British-born Australian Douglas Mawson. To my mind, those are the sort of four giants of the heroic age. And to my mind, Mawson is not enough known for what he achieved.
So what was... So could you put a bit more of a story of Mawson? I mean, as you say, he's rather sort of unheard-of character.
Yeah, he is, unfairly. Well, he was exploring another side of the continent, really because he was going from Australia, that no British people knew anything about, and nobody else was there. And he led several poorly funded expeditions and achieved tremendous things in terms of mapping and real knowledge. So now we're getting to the stage where we know it's a continent, and we know there's going to be a middle to the continent, and we know the middle of the continent will be 90 south, the South Pole. So we're still inching forward. Shackleton, of course, got to within 89 miles of the pole in his first expedition and turned back. So it was known, there was a great excitement. It was a big story of the day, really. It's like climate change now. It was known that it was in human grasp to get to 90 South and that there was a tremendous prize. So Captain Scott set out on his second expedition, and this was the huge thing and all the rest of it. And it's quite a well-known story, I think, but one that, it's one of the greatest stories ever told. Captain Scott and his four companions, well, four of his companions, five of them actually went to the pole, got there, and just as they were approaching, they were straining their eyes and they saw something flapping. And it was a Norwegian flag. And they'd been forestalled. So the psychological disaster of that cannot be underestimated. The five of them started on their really long journey back. And imagine what that was like, you know, the disappointment, failure, really. Although they tried to sort of say they had their scientific gains. They picked up lots of rocks and this and that. But it was failure, however you dress it up. And one of them quickly perished. And then another one, Captain Oates, perished. And then the three of them were pinned down by a blizzard only 8 miles from the last depot, no, 11 miles from the last depot. Then so the rest who were waiting in the hut had to sit out the winter, knowing that their five companions couldn't possibly have survived. And by a tremendous freak, when they went out searching, which they had to do in the spring, the polar spring, they did find the tent. Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason we know the story, because they found the diaries.
But weren't Scott's team meant to be met before that final...
No, you're getting mixed up with Shackleton on his transantarctic.
Apologies.
That's when the ship went down, the Endurance went down. And they said they couldn't even start out. But the other lot did start out from the other side. What had happened on the journey to the South Pole, which had been long planned, was that a large team set out with the dogs and with the ponies from Scott's base, and that... And they were planting depots along the way, depots being fuel and food. And then various parties were sent back, as they had to be sent back, because the fuel and the food, they couldn't all go. And there was various people in those parties. For example, Apsley Cherry Garrard, the writer of The Worst Journey in the World, he was the last but one party to be sent back. And then finally it was just the five who went on. And so they were coming back on their own, picking up food and fuel at the depots, which they did do, although there was various problems, not least that the fuel had been leaking out of the canisters in which it was left for mechanical reasons which aren't really known, and all kinds of other problems. And we do know that the weather was against them. I mean, if you look at the data through all the years, they were very unlucky with the temperatures.
You compared, sort of, as you said a moment ago, you compared Scott to Nelson and Shakespeare as one of the great heroes of the British public imagination. You truly captured it in a way no other did. Why? Is it something inherent about the idea of the heroic failure?
I think it helps if you die. That was Shackleton's big mistake. He didn't die. But I think also Scott was a really good writer. And these diaries, you know, the last line of the diaries and what Englishmen can do. I mean, they were stirring stuff, and it's no wonder during the war, the First War, that the army printed copies of the diaries to give to the squaddies in the trenches, because it shows what an Englishman can do and all the rest of it. It's very stirring stuff. Had Scott's diaries not been found, which, as I said, was quite freakish that they were, imagine looking for people basically an ice desert, as I say, big, 1.5 times the size of the United States. Had Scott's diaries not been found, there wouldn't have been a story to tell. He said, had we lived, I would have had a story to tell. But in fact, the story was told. Mm-hmm. And when he wrote those words in his dying days, he can't have had much hope the diaries would be found. So he said, had we lived, we would have had a story to tell, which would stir the heart of every Englishman. But the story was told. And also, I think the question you asked me about why is he so famous has a lot to do with context, as all stories, and it was the war, you see. Because when they were all at it in the heroic age, ideals, they were still ideals. People could still believe in things, in the perfection of the Englishman and the ability to conquer all and be pure. And there's, you know, I mean, he was the Galahad of the snows. I mean, the reality, you know, it's a great image for purity, the snows. And he was a Galahad of the snows. That's how he was positioned after he died. But then with the war, nobody could believe in that anymore, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. You could not believe in any of that idealism anymore, because the horror was known. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Scott was the last one.
Yeah, yeah.
He's sort of knightly. And he embodied that knightly ideal, which was never seen again and never will be seen again.
Mm. How does he compare to Amundsen?
I think the main difference between them, we can say, is that, of course, Amundsen, like many Scandinavians, had grown up on skis. And they were all extraordinarily, his team were all extraordinarily accomplished on skis. And crucially, he had learned from the peoples of the north about snowcraft, you know, how to kill seals, how to use fur, to do all kinds of things, to do a living in the polar regions. He'd learned a lot. Unfortunately, the English establishment at the time didn't really think there was anybody to be learnt from compared with us. So half of the Scots lot couldn't ski at all. One of them, of the five who went to the pole, didn't have any skis. Dog driving, a key and component of all of this. You know, the Norwegians have been driving dogs all their life and had learned how to deal with the dogs, which is not a straightforward matter, whereas our lot didn't really have a clue. And this kind of ridiculous half-baked idea to take ponies. And they hadn't learned from Shackleton, who on his first expedition had taken ponies, and it was a disaster. And the ponies that Scott had taken, nobody knew how to pick ponies, and they'd got a useless lot from Siberia, which would, as soon as the pony head of ponies, Titus Oates saw them, just as soon as he saw them, he said, "This is just a load of old crocs." And it was a spy, Cecil Mears, who'd picked them. So it was all a big disaster. So they hadn't learned. So anyway, the question you asked me about Amundsen, he wasn't like that. He just learned the hard facts and skills of snowcraft. And there wasn't really much mucking about with science, which takes up a lot of time. And he was just better at it from all points of view. Scott made a lot of mistakes, but who wouldn't have? He didn't make as many as I would have done had I been in his position. You know, for example, choosing five for the final polar party, which he did really out of emotion, whereas everything was parcelled up in terms of four people, enough fuel for four, enough food for four. That was a bad error. Besides, as I'd say, the tremendous bad luck he had in the weather. And Amundsen was a different kettle of fish altogether. Quite a hard man. Scott was very soft, and Scott was soft in a good way. Would never have made a romantic decision to take four with him because he couldn't bear to leave one out. For example, you know, Scott wanted the army represented at the pole, so he took Titus Oates, who was the only army man on the team. And so very, very different characters.
Sort of embodies that sort of, you know, practical over heroic, which, well, that was sort of the science over the heroic, which sort of the war finished off. Is that the idea?
Yeah, slightly, yeah.
Well, sorry, a bit too laboured. Something which is quite noticeable is lack of women in the story, well, in sort of the history so far. In your piece about Antarctic in the mag, you mention Ingrid Christensen. Some have said she's sort of, you know, an accompanying character, but others given her the role of her own explorer.
Okay, well, of course, we're talking about a man's world, and there's no getting away from the fact that all the female firsts in the Antarctic, the beginning, first to see it, first to set foot, they were accompanying. There's no point in trying to gloss that. But some of them were great travellers in their own right. The first person to see the continent was probably a sealer's wife in 1831. And it was a whaler's spouse, Caroline Mikkelsen, who was Norwegian. And she was probably the first to actually set foot 4 years later. Although it's disputed, and it could have been the Norwegian shipowner's daughter, Ingrid Christensen, whom you mentioned. She was an accompanying wife, but everybody agreed that she played a full part in the expedition and went ashore, landed on Scullin Monolith in Robertson Land, which is part of the actual continent, and that was her fourth trip south. So she was quite an accomplished polar traveller by that stage. Once after that period, well, a long time after that period, when scientific missions were established, supposedly for science, but first of all, it was mainly to everybody to get their oar in and stake a claim and make sure nobody else got there first. This was before even there was any thought of hydrocarbons, which we'll come to later. Then at first, it wouldn't really have occurred to anybody to have women on the team because that just wasn't done. And you can't judge them out of context of the period. It just wasn't done. And don't forget, there were far fewer female scientists in those days, for reasons we know. And eventually, and I think this is quite characteristic of how things have developed gender-wise in the world, it was the American scientific programme that first sent a woman south. She was a medical doctor, and they weren't taking any chances because she was a nun. And then after that, slowly, like in so many walks of life, the scientific quota, and indeed what they call the field assistants, so the people who assist the scientists in all kinds of ways, whether it's as cooks or stopping the scientists falling down crevasses or all kinds of things. then they are very well represented now across the board, nationwide, the Russians and the Americans being probably at the head of the field, but many, many polar scientists in the north and the south are women.
Mm-hmm. And if you could just move on to your personal experience in Antarctica. You were there for sort of 7 months, you've been there, you know, travelled there extensively. What first drew you to it?
Right, well, I'm a writer, and first and foremost, one book tends to lead to another, and I am that most unfashionable of things, a generalist. Someone's got to be one, I figure. And I'd written a book, my second book was about Chile, and I'd got to the bottom of Chile, and I thought my journey would end at Cape Horn. But then I found out that Chile is one of the seven claimants to Antarctic territory. So this slice of land, which looks like a slice of cake on Chilean maps, was sort of incredibly important for all kinds of things to do with being a young country, which is hard, I think, for a British person to understand. Mm. How it's like, it's illegal in Chile to publish a map without that slice of Antarctica on it. So I thought, oh, God, I've got to go down there now. So I did. I hitched a lift on a Chilean Air Force plane and went to Chilean Antarctica. And suddenly I saw my next book in front of me. And I thought, God, there's no people here, no indigenous people. So it'd be a really great place for a writer to do what travel writers do, which is smuggle in all types of stuff and not have to grapple with all those very hard things. Mm-hmm. About representing an indigenous culture to which you will never be a part. I thought, right, I'm going to write the first travel book ever written about the Antarctic. Well, had I known at the time how hard it was going to be, I wouldn't have had the spirit for the fight. But I mean, getting there. But it's like waiting for a bus. Once you've invested a certain amount of time in it, you can't give up. And so it took me 2 years to organise, and I went as a sort of accredited writer to various Antarctic governments and spent my time in the field in my tent going from science camp to science camp. Mm-hmm. By whatever transport was used. It was choppers often, or to places like the Pole, fixed-wing aircraft who landed on skis on blue ice, and sometimes around the edge icebreakers, and sometimes tracked vehicles. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. So I travelled a lot. As I say, science camp to science camp. And at the last 2 months, in fact, I had my own camp. And I was the American government's writer in residence. And I shared the camp with the American government's painter in residence, who, fortunately for me, turned out to be an extremely companionable woman. And her job was much harder than mine because her paints froze. Then we had a 10-day whiteout and she had to paint me inside our hut. Had a little hut we'd towed out. The science hut. The scientists hadn't arrived yet. It was August, and we towed our hut out the day after the sun rose, which is one of the few weeks of the year when Antarctica has a light cycle. Basically has 5 months of total light, 5 months of total dark, and then a month in between at each end where everything happens really fast, like the sea coming in. So that was a time just to really sort of be there and absorb it and think about the fact that this is the only unknown place on Earth. Mm. And I think, unlike everywhere else, the magic, the beauty and the magic and that unknownness of the Antarctic, that hasn't changed since Bellingshausen was down there. Mm. Which you can't say about many places in the world.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the place. Were you in touch with any wildlife at all? Did you come across anything?
Yeah, masses when I was on the edge. So this camp I had with this one other woman. It was on the off Ross Island on the Ross Ice Shelf. Mm-hmm. And that is where the Weddell seals come up in September to pup. Weddell seals are the only seals who can breed that far south because they've got special teeth which enables them to drill a hole in the ice of the ice shelf, which might be sort of, let's say, well, our camp was 12 feet thick underneath our camp. So they drill a hole in the ice, the females, when it's ready in September the time. And they come up and they flop on the ice and enormous, and they give birth and they have the milk has the highest fat content of any animal for obvious reasons. And these little pups gain 5 pounds a day. And of course, like penguins, seals have no predators on the ice or on the land. So they're not remotely afraid of people. Their predators are in the water, where they're very skillful. So they came up by our hut and pupped It was extraordinary. I mean, first of all, one's not quite used to that sort of relationship between a wild animal and a human, when they look in your eyes and they have no fear. And then these pups are born, gaining 5 pounds a day, and it's like watching dough rise. It was a really extraordinary experience. And likewise, the emperor penguins, who live in that part of the Antarctic, they were all around, not pupping at that time, but wandering about a lot. And they were fascinated by us. And there was no... I mean, we got fed up with them far quicker than they got fed up with us. Just come around and look at us. And squawk behind their backs to the others, and the others would come up. And my friend, this artist whom I was with, she had a little furry penguin mascot that somebody had given her before she left, and she put it down on the ice. Well, I promise you, those penguins are still talking about that event now. Caused a sensation. Much squawking all around, everybody waddling over, having a good look, beaks down. It was quite extraordinary because, of course, one wants to avoid the anthropomorphising of penguins. Which, I mean, that's why we love them so much, isn't it? Because they look like people in dicky boats, you know. And they have been made like in our own image. But when living with them there, and we did live with them, it seemed extraordinary to us how much curiosity they had. Why shouldn't they have curiosity? And again, it was, you don't normally see that in wild animals because they're fearful, aren't they? They won't, you know, I have a lot of foxes around here where I live in North London, increasingly actually, a lot this year. And you couldn't see what they're doing at any time because they'll scarper when they see you. So that was a very moving experience. And it is easy to romanticise. You sort of saw what it could have been like between men and the animals, except of course it couldn't have been because we have to eat them, don't we? Just like the leopard seals have to eat them. Mm.
Yeah. So untouched though it is it, is that time coming to an end, do you think?
Not any time soon, no. Not any time soon.
You mentioned the interest in hydrocarbons earlier.
Yes. The Antarctic Treaty and all its protocols, which are extremely complicated, that protects the Antarctic as it stands from any sort of mining or hard rock mining or drilling for hydrocarbons, and we don't actually have the technology yet for such low temperatures and how to keep things going half the year when it's pitch dark. But we know that our rapacious need for oil is not going to go away, and we know that when it gets to 50 times the cost per barrel, which it will when it runs out, then eyes were going to be turned to the south. Not in my lifetime, and I don't think in my children's lifetime. But after that, there will be investigation. It'll be a slow road, and to make it viable, oil would have to be more than 100 times a barrel than it is now. So it's quite a long time ahead. Mm. Oh, people go on about tourism, but I think if you look at the extent of the footprint of tourists in the Antarctic, it's just nothing compared to the rest of the world. Mm. And yes, there is pollution, and yes, scientists do find some sorts of pollutants in deep down Antarctic lakes, you know, which have got 100-foot lid of ice. But compared to problems we have elsewhere on the planet, I mean, I think if you were to make a list, or let's say an environmental scientist was to make a list of the most pressing environmental issues, I think the Antarctic probably would be about 142.
Long may it continue. To turn eyes briefly northward, you spent the time in the Arctic Circle, you also wrote a book about that as well. Inevitable question, how do the two compare?
Well, the Antarctic is a continent surrounded by water. The Arctic is water surrounded by lots of continents. So that's a pretty big difference. Mm. And the Arctic sustains life. Another huge difference. People live there. Animals live there. Mm. Things grow. When I was in the Antarctic, it seemed to me, as I've said, there was a certain symbolism about it. This is one place, we haven't mucked it up, there hasn't been a war, nobody owns it, there's no weapons, and all the rest of it. And it seemed to me a symbol of what the Earth could have been, and that's a, you know, writers have to have hope, and it was something hopeful, a symbol of hope for the future and so on. And I wasn't particularly interested in the Arctic because that's the opposite of all of that. It's polluted, it's mucked up, there's people who hate one another, there's people with money drawing indigenous peoples into the cash economy and ruining their lives. Terrible things with pollutants that have floated north in in animals from things that have long since been banned here, like those flame retardants in the 70s, which have long gone, PCBs. But they are not water-soluble, they're lipid-soluble, so fat animals, a lot of fat, like them. And that, well, they don't like them, but they can store them. And it goes up and up and up the food chain. At the end of the food chain is people who eat seals and whales and so on. But terrible, really terrible things. And we've got a lot of data for that. So the Arctic, you see, Antarctic is a symbol of what the Earth could be. The Arctic's a symbol of what the Earth is. Mm-hmm. And that's less appealing to a writer. But then once I got middle-aged and approached 50, I've done a lot of things in between. I wrote about a lot of other things after the Antarctic. But I started looking north and think, you know, that is where we are. And so I better go and have a look at it. So I did.
And on that sobering thought, I think that's a good place to end the podcast. And Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Sarah Reader's latest book, Mud and Stars, Travels of Pushkin and Other Geniuses of the Golden Age, is out now in all fine bookstores everywhere. To find the link in the description of the podcast. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.